Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
It's Joe Benigno and Evan Roberts on The Fan.
Joe and Evan. Evan and Joe. On WFAN Sports Radio. If you want to be in the New York, no. Gotta go to Joe and Evan. Evan and Joe.
And we are neither Evan nor Joe. They will be back at a later date, not today. I am Susan Waldman along with Howie Rose. And we've been sort of reminiscing with some of our great baseball friends. And another one who, by the way, we would have been playing, the New York Yankees would have been playing the Seattle Mariners, and our buddy Dave Sims would have been in town. And all we do now is go on Zoom calls together and phone. So Dave, it's Susan and Howie. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well, gang. Doing well. Good to hear your voices. You know, right about this time, as I look at the clock, I should be going, bottom of the six right now. Kyle Seager to leave it off. Here in the... I saw that come up on my phone today that this would have been the finale of that series. Oh, geez. What are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Hey, actually,
Howie, long time. How you been, man?
Doing great. How are you? Yeah, we were going to see you right after the All-Star break in New York. You wouldn't have
open the second half of the season at Citi Field, which I still haven't been to because the last two times we played the Mets, you guys came out to Seattle.
Right. That was 3 years ago was the last time we were out there. Well, just give us a little picture of, you know, you're in a different situation, even though you work for the Mariners, you're in New York right now. A picture of how you're holding up under the same sort of conditions that we are, which is to say anxious to get back, I'm sure. But what about your level of trepidation?
There's a level of trepidation, Susan and I were talking about that. We're all in that age category where we're a little bit more vulnerable. I'm a cancer survivor. So those are some circumstances that I am considering. But you know, I am enthusiastic about getting back to work. I just hope that the Players Association and the owners don't screw this thing up, and that all the organizations will take all the appropriate health and safety measures as possible. And I don't anticipate doing, if everything goes right, I don't anticipate being at the ballpark, at least not at the beginning. There's so many scenarios that could happen. I've done games off of monitors. It's not a lot of laughs, but it is what it is. But it would be nice to have baseball back. There's no question. And, you know, luckily, you know, and I'm here in New York, and I'm glad to be here. And I'm glad to see the numbers have gone down. I listen to Governor Cuomo pretty much every day. And I was just reading that the numbers in Seattle have gone down significantly in Kings County, which Seattle is a big part of. So that's very encouraging. While on the flip side, you see pictures of people down in pools in Houston, like nothing's going on. So what are you going to do?
You know, and Dave, and to make it clear, Dave is in the middle of New York City, and I think all of us that are here, and you particularly, because you're in town, you're in the city, and it's very different. I'm up, you know, in the suburbs a little bit, so at least I can walk out the door and be on my lawn. You guys can't, and Governor Cuomo, I know today, was talking about how New York, the numbers are going down, but they're going down because people are doing what they've been told to do, like wearing masks and doing all that, and that's what that is. And, you know, it's scary. It's very scary, and I think those of us that are in New York York have a different view of it than maybe the more cavalier attitude someplace else.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm here in Midtown, and, you know, the streets are pretty much empty. I had a stretch while I was indoors for 44 consecutive days. I think my wife was indoors for 60 days. We've gone for today's Monday. I think it was Friday we went to we actually did a walk to and through Central Park. And then I was very happy to see that about 90% of the people we passed along the way. And then once we got into the park, we were wearing masks. So that was encouraging. And, I've been doing a lot of, I should be doing more book reading, but I'm reading everything online and watching, currently involved in a British show called The Split that's on a Sundance channel. So that's what we're currently binging on right now.
Do you have any kind of, from people you've spoken to, gut feeling about whether they're going to be able to pull this off in the timeline that we all seem to be aiming for, which is somewhere around July 4th? And the reason I ask you is that, and you'll have a better feel for it being in New York than I do down here, but to me, we're in the middle, really, of a crucial 2-3-4 week period during which various states, and now all of them at one level or another, have opened up. And, and inevitably, when you open up, you're going to have a spike in cases. That's to be expected. But the question is, will they spike somewhat out of control in certain areas that might make it impossible to play in those cities? Do you have any idea, based on people you've spoken to, whether or not there are any pockets within this country that we should be concerned about being able to play, even if the plan is to be back by July 4th?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, Houston, I mean, I looked down there, and the picture I saw today was very disturbing. People jammed into a pool. And I think the last couple of days ago, I saw that there was a spike in the Dallas area and the Houston area. That's concerning. I haven't, you know, there have been so many things, as you know, that have been thrown out there that have been spitballed. And what's, in terms of what has been leaked out, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't have anything firm. But I just hope that, you know, it's American exceptionalism. If we are that exceptional, there's got to be some people out here that can figure some stuff out. And also we need to catch a break, too, in terms of the virus going away. But, you know, when you're having the country sort of polarized, and I'm not going to wear a mask, I'm going to wear a mask, when you have that, it's concerning. And in terms of getting back, it sort of puts a little of that in your mind that it can be pulled off.
You know, Dave, because I was struck by something you just said, because the last time we talked, which to me was 30 minutes ago or an hour ago, I thought you guys were going to be, because I talked to Howie about how great a setup you guys would have in Seattle in the booth, because they're big and they're, they're outdoors and there's all kinds of room for social distancing and all those things. And now you're saying a studio? So that's changed since the last time I talked to you?
Yeah, I talked to my stage manager. Told me that was the latest thing here, because you guys, as you know, in TV trucks, you're right on top of each other. In that front row, you got your producer, you got your director, technical director, and, you know, and they're sitting maybe 8 feet of space. Then you got the second deck, then you got the guys in the back. So the thought that he relayed to me that he had heard from one of the higher ups is that they probably would not do that, and that would necessitate us doing even home games, in the studio out in Bellevue, a little bit east of Seattle, about 10-15 minutes. Again, that's not written in concrete right now, but that's certainly something that a variable that they have at least taken a look at. So, you know, when we get closer, we'll see. We do have, as both you guys know, in Seattle at T-Mobile Park, we had a great ballpark, great room. At least in our TV booth and our radio booth, maybe it's a little bit tighter in your visiting radio booth. The visiting TV booth is pretty wide enough that you could, you know, certainly separate, you know, your stage manager, your announcer, your color, and your sound guy, your stat guy. It's doable. So, you know, we're going to see. It's so much of this is such a wait and see. I mean, speculate till the cows come home and then go out again. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Right. And, let's forget about this for a minute. I want to know your thoughts and what your years at FAN. You were part of that great duo, that great morning duo, the Coleman and the Soul Man, you and Eddie C. And and we were all part of that. And when WFAN was just growing up, and I did some updates for you sometimes and stuff, what was that like for you working here?
Well, it was interesting. I was competing against Art Rush Jr. when I got going in March of 86. I was at WNBC. Howard had just left. Imus was still rolling. So we go, NBC gets out of the business October of 88. I come over full-time FAN with Eddie in September of 89. I didn't know Eddie from the Man on the Street, but I'd heard him with Mike Francesa. They used to be on in the mornings. And, you know, a nice white Irish Catholic guy from Boston. You got a black Catholic guy from Philly. Hey, what could happen? What could go right? What could go wrong? It went well. You know, I think they were looking for sparks. I think they – I found out, you know, after I left and after the whole thing fell apart, I got some vibes from some people who were in position. I think they were looking for the angry black man and me. And then to be a combustible component going against Eddie. And it turned out we were on the same page in a lot of things. And personality-wise, I think we had one blow-up in like three-plus years. And the other thing, we like to talk to not only your A-listers in terms of, you know, Yankees, Giants, Mets, you know, that whole group. But we like to give voice and hear stories from the college, not only maybe the regional college, football guys, national college football guys, and ditto college basketball. Loved it. Imus was a pisser. A lot of times I'd be opening the show and he'd already disconnected the mic. I'm sitting there going, "Hey, everybody, welcome." And then I'm not going out and new thing is playing. I mean, you know, that kind of stuff. And then Larry Kenny gave us the Stoneman and the Coleman, which I wasn't particularly fond of, but I'll say one thing. Everybody remembers it. So I guess that's part of it. That's part of branding. That's
Larry created that? That wasn't
Larry Kenny.
That was Larry?
Larry Kenny. One of the great voiceover actors and voice actors of all time.
You know, it's interesting. It's funny to hear you say it. They wanted Ed Coleman to be combustible. I mean, he might be the nicest human being on the face of the earth.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. They were looking for me to be that guy to light the match, and we would both be going at it. It's like we agreed.
They hired the wrong people for that.
Right, exactly. And the difference, you know, we took generally, we weren't looking to blow people up, you know. And let's find a story. We're talking about sports. We're doing everything but having a beer. Well, we went and had some beers eventually, obviously. But it was sort of a meeting house type of situation. Hey, come on in. It's like Vince Kelly saying, come on, you know, put your feet up and go on in. And we're
pull up
sports.
A chair.
Yeah, exactly. Wave your sombrero to the sky.
Well, no, I thought it would, but that's what happens when you get two people that are actually sports professionals and have actually covered games and have actually been in clubhouses and locker rooms.
Bingo.
And you put together, bingo, that's what you're going to do. Are you still doing that show with Coach K?
Oh, yeah, 15 years. We just finished, first week in April, we did our last show, SiriusXM, working for another FAN alum, Steve Cohen, over at SiriusXM. Mm. 15 years with Coach K. And our last show was with a point guard at Regis High School, 5'7". You know him, you love him, Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Really?
Coach K said, he says, Dr. Fauci, he was so proud. I remember, it's Mike Krzyzewski, one of the greatest sports names in American history. And it was like he was a fanboy. And he said, Dr. Fauci, you're America's point guard. You got to get us through this. I'm going to listen to what you say. I'm sitting there going, this is amazing. Usually you hear people, even guys like Saban and Belichick and so many of the big people that we've had a chance to speak to during the course of the 15 years. They're like that, bowing down to Coach K. There's Coach K giving it to Fauci. It's been a great run. I met Mike when he was the coach at Army. I was at the Daily News late 70s, and that's how
wow.
It was.
Wow.
Well, the first time I met Dave, actually, Susan, you wouldn't remember this. I don't think you wouldn't have been in New York then, but I was working at WHN, which was 1050, and that was where WFAN began on the 1050 frequency until MS Broadcasting bought the NBC O&Os, and we moved down the dial to 660, where we're talking from today. Well, back in the late 70s, when I was the sports director at HN, they had me bring in some athletes, New York athletes, to be guest disc jockeys in the morning. Now, this was a country music station.
Oh, my goodness.
And somehow they wanted, remember this? They wanted every team that I could possibly connect with represented. So Bernard King was playing for the New Jersey Nets, and there was Bernard as the morning disc jockey, the guest disc jockey, one morning playing country music. And Dave, who was with, I guess, the New York Daily News at the time, covering the Nets. Yeah, he was there to cover Bernard King's performance as a DJ. How did he do? I don't even remember it.
That is true. You know, that is, you bring that up. I might have to think on that one for a little bit. I do remember doing that. I don't remember specifics. But there was a certain, there's a lot of incongruity there to see Bernard King spinning country. Hey, everybody, here's Waylon Jennings here. I just remember it was a fun time. I don't remember too many specifics, but you got to be talking like 77, 78.
It's exact. Well, wow. 78, 70. Yeah, right. Late 70s for sure. It's a while ago.
Wow. Was indeed. Wow. And Howie, I've been in New York since 1968. So I just had another career. So I was I was here. I just wasn't doing sports at the time. You know,
You could sing The Impossible Dream all you want, but until you're doing updates on July 1st, 1987, it didn't matter.
That's exactly right. I wasn't in the top 50 of update people. Let's put it that way.
Susan, what was your record singing the national anthem before Nick James? Because I know at one point you were well over 500.
49-2.
Yeah, like I said, and, well over 500.
Yeah, that's 49-2, and the two were playoff games when the Knicks lost to Michael. And what I used to do, and when it's playoffs, you know, they have the national anthem early, and it became like an omen. I would go out, the team would be announced, they'd go out in the two rows, I'd go out, I'd sing the anthem, and they'd play ball. The two times we lost had nothing to do with Michael Jordan. I know it had nothing to do with Michael Jordan, but the two times they lost, they made me sing the anthem 10 minutes before they went to, you know, broadcast it. And I remember Patrick saying, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. Of course, I'm telling you, it had nothing to do with Michael Jordan. But
Susie, you'll get a kick out of this. You are my reference point in Seattle or wherever we are around Major League Baseball. And if somebody does not get it under 106, 107, I said they did not meet the Susan Waldman standard. Right, we're ready for action. Marital baseball.
Yep. 105. Yeah. 105. The only one who sang at the same length, I did 105, Patti LuPone, who also used to sing for Ranger games a lot,
right,
in the 80s, also. 105, my idea about the national anthem, sing the song, get the heck off the field, or get the heck off the ice, or get the heck off the court. They didn't come to see you. You're not going to get a record contract. Sing the song the way it's wrong. It's not an interpretive piece, and get the heck off of there.
I stand and I'm applauding you right now because I remember back, I think my second year with the Mariners, we're playing in Atlanta, weekend series, July. It's got to be easy, 95. And a girl had just come from church and clearly was feeling good. And she won a $1.45 in the national anthem. And I was looking for security. So we get her out of here. The strange things we come across and covering all these games. It's been fun, I tell you. Growing up in Philly, I always wanted to do baseball, baseball, ESPN, 93, 94, and then again, I think 04, 05. And this has just been one of the great experiences in my career doing baseball for the last, this is my 14th year. Mm. All I'm asking for now, I got to call a playoff game. Holy cow. Mariners haven't been to the playoffs since 01.
Yeah, you got a way to go.
You know what? Right now, we'll settle for calling a preseason game because we don't know if there's even going to be a season, but we're certainly hoping that one's coming. And Dave, we thank you so much for joining us and catching up. member of the WFAN Alumni Association, Dave Sims. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. Right, talk to you soon.
My dues are paid up. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Good to be with you guys. Take care.
You too. All right, that is Dave Sims with us on The Fan. Howie Rose along with Susan Waldman.
Sports Radio 101.9 FM. The Fan. And Sports Radio 66 WFAN.
It is 3:32 in the afternoon. Howie Rose and Susan Waldman with you on The Fan until 5 o'clock. Still to come. And a little after 4 o'clock, we will chat with a former broadcast partner of mine, Tom McCarthy, now the TV voice of the Philadelphia Phillies. Jerry Mathers, as the Beaver, is going to be with us at 4:20 to reflect on his late friend, Ken Osmond, better known to the world as the inimitable, iconic Eddie Haskell. And at 4:45, we'll hear from the TV voice of the world champion Washington Nationals, Bob Carpenter. But right now, we are joined by a person who has worked in baseball in New York for the Mets since 1980. And frankly, I would defy, and Susan, I'm sure you'll agree with this, I would defy anyone to have a bad word to say about Jay Horowitz, because I've never heard one. And Jay has finally put his 40 years of experience into a book. It's called Mr. Met. Jacob DeGrom did the foreword. Jay Horowitz is the author. And Jay, thanks for spending some time with us this afternoon.
Susan,
what made you finally decide?
Yeah, for me to be with you guys.
Well, I appreciate
it,
but I've got to ask you. No, it did hit double digits. I'm proud to report.
Jay!
I know. You got to understand, Jay has been cajoled by everyone who's known him at least half of the 40 years that he's been with the Mets, and I'm certainly one of them, who has said, come on, Jay, you got to write a book. You got to write a book. And Jay always rejected it out of hand. He said, nope, I don't want to do it. It's not me. What made you finally decide to do it?
Well, you know what? Not that I'm 23 anymore, I'm getting near the end of my career. You know, throughout my whole life, I've always been able to make people laugh, to make fun of myself. As, you know, John Fracchi always used to tell me, if the boys didn't like you, they wouldn't screw with you. And they must have liked me a little bit because they screwed with me a lot. And I thought, let me make people laugh and tell some funny stories, what it's like to be part of the Mets for 40 years. That's what I did, some humorous stories, hopefully people laugh, just maybe cry a little bit, a couple parts of the book. And I just try to... You know, now's as good a time as any, and I was able, I think, to put a book where it didn't hurt anybody, I don't want to make anybody mad, just want to tell some funny stories and, you know, make myself the butt of a lot of the jokes.
You know, Jay, one of the things, and I started reading that, and you made me smile when I saw the name Arthur Richman, whom, you know, obviously after his long career with the Mets went over to the Yankees, and he would always talk about you, and the fact that you just put in Arthur Richman, for people that don't know, was the traveling secretary for the Mets for like 120 years, and then he came over to the Yankees, and you told some great stories. He knew everybody, and my favorite, and I don't know that you know this, is that I was walking in the office once, and his secretary said, Arthur, President Bush is on the line, and Arthur, without a moment, said, which one?
Yeah.
And that was Arthur, right?
Can I tell you, we were in Pittsburgh, I forget the year, he fell in the stadium, and he went back to the hotel, and his hotel, the rang, it was Dick Nixon was on the phone for him. He called to see how Arthur was. But I'll tell you what, he was so good for me. He introduced me to Pete Rose, George Brett, Joe Torre, went to Joe's restaurant at Ponte's down the village. And everybody I met, here's our new PR guy, be nice to him. And Arthur was so far out of his way to be nice to me. He and Martha were a delightful couple, and I would get it to Arthur for all that he taught me about to get along in the big league. He was a good, good man. He was a really good man.
You know, when Jay started with the Mets in 1980, the team had just been sold. They had been a bad club for a few years, certainly going back to the Tom Seaver trade in 1977. And the attendance and interest in the Mets had fallen to really all-time lows in franchise history. So Jay, who had been a sports information director at Fairleigh Dickinson University, needed to be creative to try and get some attention for the Mets at a period in time where the Yankees certainly ruled the city. What were the couple or three of the most creative things that you did with the Mets to get them some exposure, airtime, or anything else that at least drew some attention to them?
Well, one almost got me fired, Harry. Doug Flynn just signed a 5-year contract after the 80s season with the Country and Western singer. He started with the Oak Ridge Boys. So I came up with the idea, let's hold this press conference in a Country and Western nightclub in Manhattan. Frank Cash had agreed. Everybody wore cowboy hats, and they snapped a picture. Frank's hat fell down over his head. It was on the back page of the Daily News the next day. He looked like Elmer Fudd. I mean, the hat was all over.
Oh, it had no chance.
And Frank called me and said, Jay, what are you doing? You got to protect me. And thank God I survived that year. We did stories on Lee Mazzilli, an ice skater, Craig Swan, Ralphine, Joel Youngblood, going hunting with bows and arrows. I used to invite all my friends from college and high school to sit in the back of the press box in the early 80s. It was very, very vacant press box at that time.
And he's not kidding. Frank Cashin in a cowboy hat looked like Yosemite Sam. I mean, that was the most ill-fitting.
One of my better moments.
You know, but here's,
here's one you talk about in the book. You talk about moments, and maybe, Susan, you know this story or not. When Jay went for his job interview, talk about almost not getting the job.
Right.
What did you do that almost got you thrown out of the office before you even sat down?
Can I just back up for 1 second? So I had accepted a job. Mike Cohen used to be at SID in Manhattan College, good friend of mine, passed on in really early age. He hooked me up to be the staff guy for Tony Kubek and Joe Garagiola. I accepted a job maybe in January or February. About 10 days later, I get a call from somebody. He says, I'm so-and-so for the Mets. You'd like to offer your job as a PR guy. You want to come and interview. I hung up the phone on the guy. I thought it was a friend of mine. So about 3 days later, the guy calls back. I said, what have I got to lose? I go down to St. Petersburg. I was supposed to go to the Edgewater Beach Hotel. I went to the Hilton Hotel. I was late for the interview, so I got to the hotel. Frank is sitting there in his little white tennis shorts. I was so nervous. I went to introduce myself. I knocked over this huge container of orange juice all over his lap. I said, oh, my God, it's not going real well. The interview lasted about 5 minutes. I went back to the airport. I called my late mother. Mom, there's no way I got this job. And, you know, 40 years later, I'm still here. I don't know how, but I still made it.
You know, I'm one of the things, and there are great stories in here, and the thing that everybody else that was not with the Mets really appreciated was, you know, a lot of PR people, well, can you get me so-and-so? Well, you know, go ask them. I don't know. World Series 2000, I remember asking Jay for a couple of people, well, okay, I can get you, you know, Joe Birdbath at 248. And I'm going, okay. I'm standing there with my little microphone. 248, out comes Jay. Yeah. You know, that just doesn't happen in baseball. And I remember the guys in Boston telling me about the 86 World Series, how, you know, the Boston clubhouse was a tough place in those days. But if Jay Horwitz said, I'll get you Gary Carter at 330, out comes Gary Carter at 330. So it's not just funny stories, and Howie, you'll agree with this. You know, this man, you know, is at the top of the PR mountain, for as far as I'm concerned.
I try with
He also has a heart as big as.
Try to, you know, let the guys know every time I came to him, it wasn't just to ask all the time. I try to treat the 25th guy like the number one guy, you know, and that's I was able to get through all the years. I think the guys knew that I cared about him. Just not trying to get another interview, like cared about their personal life. I could help them get tickets to a Knick game or a Ranger game or help them with their family, with their houses. I try to just be not, you know, what could you do for Jay Horwitz? You know, I try to let them know I gave a damn about him. That's the way, you know, I approach my job. And more times than not, the guys never really let me down. And, you know, and I was something to be proud of. I still speak to most of these guys today. And that's what I'm most proud of. I try to treat everybody the same.
You also, if I'm not mistaken, were voted a full share when the Mets won the World Series in 1986, which is something that PR directors did not, at least at that time, and I don't even know about now, routinely get. Was that a shock to you? Did you have any idea that was coming?
I didn't know what share was then. It was middle of September. We were playing pretty well, and Keith Hernandez called me up to his room, and he says, I got some good news and some bad news for you. He said, what's the good news? Well, the players voted you a full share for the World Series, and the bad news is there'd be probably some people upset with you because this doesn't usually happen. So, make a long story short, we won the thing, and it was $93,000. So I got called up to the office, and somebody explained to me, well, you have two choices, Jay. You can accept the $93,000 the players voted you, which they shouldn't have, or a $4,000 bonus for being a department head. So I called my mother. I said, Mom, what do you think? $93,000 or $4,000
My
mother said to me, my mother said, I didn't raise a schmuck. Take the 93. So I called back. I said, you know what? I'm taking the 93.
Well, wait a minute. Was that a joke? Did somebody actually say that to you?
Yeah, they were not happy that the play, you know, they thought that I politicked and
who's they?
And anybody knows you, that's not me. When Keith called me in, I had no idea what a share was. No idea what a share was at that time. And I was kind of, was honored. And I, you know, Keith, I do this thing not because I'm looking for money or this or that, you know, and I just did it because that's the way I do things. And I was given the opportunity, 93 or 4. I put left 93, on right side, 4,000. Oh, well, 93 is probably better.
Yeah, just flip a coin, you know, yeah, you can't go wrong, right?
And you know what? Money. And Howie, as you remember, that was not an easy group, that 86 group. There were some characters on that team.
Yeah, I never knew what to expect when I got to the ballpark. It was in the, they kept me busy. But you know what? I'm probably closer to that team than any other team because I'm my age. I started when I was 34 and 80. So I was still, you know, I used to go out, have dinner with the guys, you know. But they, you know what made that team great? There were a lot of different personalities, but they got together on a team. They played as a team, and you know they respected. Like Gary Carter never ran out and ran. He, you know, went back to the hotel, had his dinner, and but the guys, you know, kidded him a little bit. But he was part of the fabric. He was, you know, he did the all the analytics before analytics came to be, and he nurtured the pitching staff. And that was really, he was the godsend to all the young pitchers, you know, Doc and, you know, and Sid and Ronnie Darling. He really got them through. And, you know, like I said, Gary unfortunately passed away at 57, much too young to die. Mm.
What were the challenges, Jay, and what are the challenges even to this day? I mean, some of which comes up in the book, some of which, you know, didn't need to really be in a book. But, you know, there are various episodes that players are involved in that you need to sort of intercede in to keep their heads above water, whether it was Doc's drug situation, Darryl's varied problems back then, you know, even Lenny Dykstra later on. I mean, he's still a member of the Mets Alumni Association for all the stuff that's happened. How has that tested your friendships and relationships with those players? And has there been any strife and tension created because of that?
Yeah, it really has. I mean, like all those guys you mentioned, you know, put Lenny aside because I really haven't dealt with him in much of recent years. But, you know, with Doc and Darryl and even Keith when he had his problems in the mid-'80s, they were all up front with stuff. We used to talk and, you know, get it out in the open, don't hide. And they just were, you know, they didn't lie. They didn't want to cover up. They didn't run. You know, even like in the 86 World Series, Doc didn't have too good outing. He stood in that way out in right field in the press area in Boston and took his medicine. Darryl never, ever hid. And, you know, Darryl and Doc are, you know, they turned around their lives. Darryl is a minister with his wife. Doc is doing a lot of good stuff, you know, working with hospitals and kids. You know, the guys were up front, and I think they knew they trusted me when I was telling them, you know, not to hide, to be up front, say what happened was good or bad. And I think that's why they, to this day, that both of those guys are pull-up figures in New York, you know, they screwed up, and they said it. And that's why they trusted my opinion, Howie, to be honest with you.
And another thing that goes along with that, and this is me talking now, this isn't them, but I can sense this knowing them and knowing the relationship you have with them, is that you believed in them. I mean, it's so easy to give up on somebody when he is at the depths of the personal problems that some of those guys experienced, and much of it, if not all of it, really, of their own doing. But I'm telling you, Susan, this guy has a heart as big as the biggest continent you could imagine.
I visited Darryl when he was in jail. I visited Dwight when he had his drug problems. It's easy to be a friend to somebody when they hit 52 home runs or pitch a no-hitter. I think the one guy where I think I kept trust with them I try to be with him in the good and the bad times. You know, I try to be there, not just be there when the shining moments. I try to let them know that I cared about them as people. And I'm really proud to say that, you know, most of these guys, when I call them, they'll pick the phone up. You know, they're still friends of mine. And that's what I, you know, treasure all the 40-plus years I've worked there.
You know, Howie, and you brought up the whole thing as Jay has a heart and the players trust him. And being a visiting person, I know I'm on the other side of the city. But I've known when I've come over, I'll say to Jay, who's good to talk to? And sometimes it's tough over there. And once I remember when Ari Dickey came over for the first, came over immediately, he said, the guy in the corner, I told him to talk to you, the one reading Chaucer, he's over there. That's Ari Dickey. But if Jay brought me to a player, the player would always give me a very honest and wonderful. It was like a star. It was like it was okay. Yeah. If Jay said talk to this woman, they did, and it was there was no fear, no nothing, because of it. And you notice that, and I've been doing this 34 years, so you notice that, and it doesn't happen other places. And so if Jay brought you over to a player, this is Susan Waldman of the Yankees. Yeah. They smile and they talk to you, but it's because of you, Jay. It's not because they know me.
Can I bring this up? Both you guys were involved. I have a chapter in the book, Shannon Ford, who worked for me for 22 years, and both you guys were really very kind to Shannon. I know you used to correspond with her, Susan.
Yep.
She always used to tell me that, how much of a sounding board you were for her, and she was always there when she would call you or text you, and I just wanted to bring that up, and Howie was always very kind to her and said nice things about to her, and I just, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book. You know, Shannon passed away four years ago, in 2016. When people die, people forget. And I just didn't want anybody to forget what she did for the Mets, the way she conducted her life. You know, she had cancer, breast cancer, it spread, and she fought like hell. She went to the 2015 World Series and just bled orange and blue, and was a mother of two young kids, and she fought to the end. I think it's important. You know, if anybody reads any chapter in this book of mine, I just hope they read that chapter, what she did and how much she fought and how much she meant to me and to the Mets organization.
Shannon was a daughter to Jay. There's no question about it. And I know that, the bond that they shared will continue eternally. And you'll really, I think, be struck by just how poignant the chapter and the segment on Shannon is. But Jay, as we just go back to the genesis of this book, you had to have so many stories that you immediately eliminated from consideration because you wanted to do an upbeat book, as you talked about.
Right.
So which would you say is your favorite story, or maybe your favorite couple of stories that you sat on for all these years that you told for the first time in these books that you can now reveal?
The plane ride from Houston was not going to happen in the book, coming back from the playoffs. That was not going to happen. The stuff when I, when Doc and Darrell were having their problems, what went on between me and them was not going to happen, and it was just, I just got to, what good is it to do to get one or two lines about anything done to stay? And then, but when a book comes out, you make somebody who's been your friend for your life long. What did you do this for? And I'm not going to make $1 million from this book. I'm not going to make whatever it is. I just want to have a feel good book, not to make people mad, just to make them laugh, especially at this time. I just feel kind of uncomfortable talking about a book I've written in this time because so many people are losing their job. Everybody, we're fighting the virus. People are dying, almost 100,000 deaths. 39 million unemployed. So I just hope people and Met fans basically will get a kick out of reading some funny stories and, about what it was like to be behind the scenes for 40 years.
So which is your favorite one of those stories?
Which is my favorite one?
Does it include John Franco?
Well, probably my favorite one. Okay, it does include John. This is my favorite story. John, I could write the whole book on all the jokes Johnny Franco played on me. This is my favorite. We're in the old Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles. So Johnny unscrews a horse head from the horse in the lobby, gets my keys to my room, puts the horse on my bed, gets ketchup, puts ketchup on the pillow, puts the horse under the bed, shuts my lights off. I go into my room, and I thought he was going to have a heart attack. And I look in my room, I got a dead horse in my bed. And he and Johnny, my three other players, were standing outside my room laughing hysterically. The other one I could say, you know, David Wright has a dark side, too, if you can't believe that. So my eyesight is not great, it's how we will attest to. I always watch the games with binoculars. So sometimes, stupidly, I leave the binoculars in the clubhouse. So David wears eye black under his eyes. So occasionally, maybe three or four times a year, he'll get the eye black, put it on my binoculars. I'll go up to the press box, watch a game, put the binoculars down, and somebody say, "What's the matter with your eyes, Jay? Look, you got into a fight." Again, I look like Susan. I look like Petey from The Little Rascals. I have the eye black. You know, Johnny used to put white out on my glasses. Used to slip my ties while I slept, put rats in my work bag. I mean, he used to put ice cream sandwiches in my suit, you know. I mean, there was anything. But you know what? He's probably one of my closest friends in the game. He played Santa Claus for 14 years. He's got a big heart, and he's a good friend. And he told me, he said, if they didn't, we don't like it, we wouldn't go near you. So hopefully they like me a little bit.
A little bit.
Well, everybody in baseball who knows Jay Horowitz loves him, never mind likes him. And I'm going to recommend this book as fiercely as I can. It's a great read, great story. Mr. Met by Jay Horowitz. Thanks for joining us, buddy.
Well, Susan Howard, my bother be. I hope to get to see you guys soon.
I hope so, Jay. Take care of yourself. Stay healthy.
Stay safe, everyone, okay?
Okay, thanks, Jay.
You too, Jay.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
One of the best people on this earth.
Without question. And he could have done a book like this 20 years ago and had an equal number of stories to tell because, he's been involved in every facet of the Mets organization for so long. But you'll read this book and you'll just come away smiling because every story is happy and upbeat. And that's what you are at the end of any time you spend with Jay, right?
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.